You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On June 17th, Britain's Royal Academy of Arts published a post on Instagram saying, "Thank you to all those for bringing an item in the RA shop by an artist expressing transphobic views to our attention. We were unaware of the artist's stated views, and their work will not be stocked in the future. We appreciate you holding us to account on this issue, and we would like to reiterate that we stand with the LGBTQ+ community." They were talking about artist Jesta Walls, a textile artist who creates beautiful work and tackles subjects like feminism and misogyny and, in general, woman-centered issues and themes via embroidery. After this attempt by the Royal Academy to cancel her, thanks to complaints from a very small number of activists, Jess refused to sit down and shut up and instead spoke out, which led to thousands and thousands of people leaping to her defense in anger and a ton of media coverage, most of which denounced the Royal Academy's decision and response. I spoke with Jess on Wednesday about her background, her art, and her failed cancellation. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I know you've been really busy and overwhelmed, and you're probably exhausted from everything that's going on, but I'm looking forward to talking to you nonetheless.
I'm looking forward to talking to you. I've been following your your journey for a while. So
yeah, it's been quite a journey. before we get into what happened with the recent attempted cancellation, I'm going to say, I'm curious to know a little bit about you and where you came from. I understand you grew up in communist East Berlin. What was that like?
Well, you know, I mean, I was six when the wall came down, so it's not really that I could say, oh, I remember when we, you know, I've got like childhood anecdotes from then I kind of remember. But I think because it's such a sort of monumental historical thing, there's so much that I've learned about it afterwards that I guess memory just sort of merges with the knowledge that you have later. So I have little things where I remember that my parents, you know, they would say, don't tell anyone that you watch Sesame Street because it was West television and you were not allowed to watch West television. But of course, you can't stop satellite, you know, rays. And so because the Stasi was everywhere. And so it could be your friends, it could be your neighbors, it could be, you know, the kindergarten teacher or whatever. And so it's a bit tricky when you have little kids. That's the sort of stuff that I remember. And then, of course, because my parents lived there for their formative years, lots of things are just sort of embedded, you know, when that's the thing that you grow up with and live with. But I was six when the wall came down, and then things changed quite rapidly. But at the same time, I mean, you know, things like the Stasi didn't exist anymore and such things. But there's obviously a big hangover from then, and there's still a difference between East Berlin for sure and West Berlin, because it's a city, you know, where East Germany and West Germany is slightly different in the sense that there was literally the wall going just zigzaggy through one city. So yeah, I mean, it's had the hangover in that what's happening right now, it just feels really reminiscent of that kind of, you know, culture of fear and not knowing who to trust and what to say to, because they could rat you out. And of course, the consequences in East Berlin were much more dire if you were sort of against the party and all such, you know, crap. But now they're still pretty steep already, that you lose your job, you get harassed, you get all this sort of stuff. But it is eerily reminiscent. And what's different now is that was a specific place. You know, we've seen things like that in different parts of the world. But this thing feels so pernicious because it's everywhere, you know.
It's interesting to me because I feel like people, I mean, obviously some people see things as they are and as you've described them, and they think it's reminiscent of these kinds of systems. And but at the same time, like, it's strange because a lot of people who consider themselves to be really progressive, forward thinking, you know, maybe liberal people or leftist people, I wouldn't call them actually liberal, but, you know, people who vote for the Democrats or whatever, they really seem to have a blind spot here, and they think that what they're doing is a positive thing. You know, they think that they're affecting positive change in the world. They don't see it as repressive and regressive and dangerous and all of that.
Yeah, but I think that's really, I mean, that's not new, I don't think. That's just what's happened throughout history. You know, like, enough time passes and we just forget. There's like a collective amnesia of those things happening. But I don't think it's entirely new that people get swept up in a frenzy, whatever that is, be it for good or for bad. Because usually for most sort of strange mass movements, people thought they were on the right side of history at the time, you know, and thought they were doing the good thing. And that's the problem, isn't it, with pluralistic ignorance, where people just kind of go along because they think it's the right thing to do. And then some people question it. But then at some point we reach the point, which we have passed, where people are too scared to then say something. But I don't think that's new. I think that's happened before. It's just now it feels so odd because it's such modern times, you know. And it feels something historical, rather.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, people do, unfortunately, forget. And they don't see the, you know, similarities between these kinds of systems, even when they're right in front of them. But, yeah, I mean, it's happening in Canada, big time, where I'm from. And, you know, yeah, I think everyone's noticed. Yeah. We're famous for all the wrong reasons. And, but, you know, like, I think people just think of Canada as such a progressive place and such a good place and such a, you know, open-minded and inclusive place, yeah, that they just can't possibly imagine. It's like their brains cannot accept the idea that, you know, maybe a bad thing could be happening in Canada. You know, maybe this is not a good thing just because it's presented as a good thing. Like, people are really, really like, no, this is Canada, not in Canada. We have healthcare.
Yeah. No, but I noticed, I mean, I had some of the worst kind of vile bile sort of sent to me from Canada. Right. When I came out with the stuff the first time around 2 years ago, you know, that, like, honestly, like, some of the worst stuff, like, abuse, I guess, I don't know what you want to call it, just like really hideous messages came from Canadians. Yeah. Which was, you know, yeah, that was my first sort of taste of the, you know, Canadian Kool-Aid.
Canadian politeness? Yeah, I mean, that's also what we're famous for. And when you say that, it doesn't surprise me at all, because, I mean, I think probably the worst that I've been subjected to I'm positive, absolutely the worst that I've been subjected to is from within Canada, from within other Canadians, from, you know, Canadian, like, academics, you know, like, people who teach at universities, and not just, you know, people who teach at universities, but profs who teach at, like, my alma mater, like, the university that I went to, and then, of course, all of the activists and, you know, people, politicians, you know, people who are members of the NDP, our leftist political party, you know, like, people, like, union members, like, all these people who I was totally politically aligned with for my whole life and who I supported. You know, I was a supporter of the NDP for a really, really long time. I was, like, a big labor movement supporter, so on and so forth. And in Canada, it's just, it's been the, you know, the worst experience dealing with all these people here. So, and you know, I think these people refuse to think of themselves as other, anything other than being on the right side of history and of, like, very nice, really good people who care about, you know, violence and marginalization and oppression and injustice and all of that.
All the while.
Yeah.
being some of the worst perpetrator of all of that.
Yeah, when it comes to women.
I mean, it's striking. It is striking, the blind spot. It's
yeah. So tell me about your art, first of all. What is it that you do and why?
Well, I mean, I'm a textile artist, I suppose. I mean, I've done all sorts of different things over the years, but textile art is kind of where I feel most at home. And at the moment, specifically, it's embroidery art, which I've been doing maybe for the last 5 years. And before then, I used to sew big sort of sculptural textile portraits. I mean, it's always had a very feminist angle, but shamefully, it had quite a lib-femmy angle for quite a few years until I sort of started to realize, I guess, what was happening around me. Because I just sort of walked along with it literally from the kind of, oh, yeah, you know, let just everybody, you know, from a liberal point of view, let's just everybody live and let live and all that. And I just did not see the ideology seeping into things. And then I started to, because I use my art to sort of express the stuff that bothers me or that, you know, anything that sort of concerns me. My art is sort of my medium to express it. You know, you talk and you write. For me, I tend to stitch and put my thoughts into pictures, and then people can make of it what they want to interpret it. But when all this stuff sort of came to a head, I felt like not just stitching, because I did do an embroidery alongside the blog that I wrote, but I also wrote the blog. Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what I do all day, every day, except when some major arts organization tries to cancel me. But yeah, that's essentially it. I mean, it explores all sorts of subjects, you know, like domestic violence or, you know, period or bodies, body parts. You know, I've done like a vulva embroidery workshop at the Tate a few years ago for lots of people. Yeah, the kind of thing that you can't do anymore without being called transphobic now, you know.
Right. Female yeah. body parts, anything that references women or females, clearly bigoted. Has your work been controversial?
Well, it depends on who you ask, I guess, you know. I mean, if someone's very conservative and you put a big fat vagina in front of their face, maybe that would be, you know, controversial, but I think it only became controversial when I sort of touched this whole clusterfuck. yeah, I mean, controversial for those that think that I am the worst person on earth right now. But otherwise, actually not controversial at all, you know? it really just says the stuff that a lot of people are too afraid to say now. So, you know. I guess it really depends on who you're asking.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so funny what is controversial these days, right? Like, things that really aren't controversial or should not be controversial are somehow very controversial. So it's hard to describe things that, you know, I don't think, and obviously you don't think, are actually controversial things as being controversial. So and when was it that you sort of started to get involved in the conversation around gender identity?
That was pretty much, I would say, at the start of 2019. Well, that's when I started to sort of gather the, so it must have been earlier than that, because that's when I started to write the blog. So I think I've started to think about it probably already a year before then, because of how people started to behave around me and talk, and the kind of, you know, slight but polite dictating tone, you know, I would say stuff, because I mean, you might have noticed I'm kind of quite straightforward. And so, you know, I would say something and then people around me would say things like, ooh, that's problematic. And that word came up a lot, which I absolutely loathe. That's problematic, because that just, I mean, that's been utilized way too much for way too many times the wrong reasons. And And so I ask questions. So if someone would say that, I wouldn't just go like, oh, okay, I'm not going to say anymore. I'd be like, why is that problematic? And then people would try to explain it to me, which made it worse, you know? And I'd be like, what? How? What? How do you even reason that to yourself? And that kind of got more and more extreme in a really short amount of time. I just did not see that around me before. I did. Maybe I just didn't pay attention enough to it, or I don't know. This is the thing, you know, when people say, oh, how can they not see this, that what they're doing? And even though I had never heard of the term TERF, or I never really, you know, I never stood there and said, yeah, trans women are women or anything like that. I never had that. I was just literally always of the, you know, live and let live. What's it to me? Because I didn't look closer and I didn't see what problems this brings up. And I didn't understand how lunacy, like how loony the demands have become either. You know, I did not understand that when they say trans women are women, they actually meant literally, you know? And so I kept asking questions and the answers just became more and more bonkers. And it just made me really dig deeper. And I mean, that was a rabbit hole. And then I kind of came across you. Learned a lot that way. And I watched a lot of the Benjamin A. Boyce, learned a lot that way. And it just, my brain started to kind of explode or implode rather more and more because of what was, you know, I was working in a liberal arts theater. I was in the thick of this and it was happening around me. And so I think because of where I worked, it happened so much quicker and it was so much more intense all of a sudden, you know, it seemed to just all of a sudden really have amped up. And so I found myself in that situation where I thought, well, how the hell am I going to make art if I'm going to be called transphobic at any turn, you know, by portraying female reproductive organs and all that, you know? I've got my little side hassle swinging ovaries that I sort of like made a little brand out of, and people would start saying, oh, well, that's problematic, you know, because not just women have ovaries. I'm like, what are you on about? And so it sort of directly clashed with what I'm interested in working with and about with my art. And I thought, well, I don't really consider myself as, you know, like a little embroiderer who makes pretty little doilies and that's it. And it's fine. I mean, there's a place for that too. But that's not, you know, I consider myself an artist and currently I use embroidery as a medium. And I don't know, maybe one day in the future, I'll wake up and go, now I'm going to paint or whatever, you know, like I don't consider myself as part of the embroidery community. I mean, apparently I'm not anyway, because I caused a transphobic rapture, but it's just, yeah, I don't know. It's been a wild ride since then, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt like I have to make my points clear in order to free myself from this thought restriction or thought expression restriction, more like. It felt like if I just go along with this, then I can either choose to no longer do what I do and explore what I want to explore, or I can speak up and then deal with the consequences. And although I thought they might be really harsh because I sort of saw what happened to you, but then again, I thought, well, that's Canada. But, you know, because, I mean, the UK has a really strong sort of feminist history with grassroots movements. And, you know, I mean, you've been to the woman. I watched you on stage at the Women's Place UK where you were speaking. And there's a whole bunch of really kick-ass women here, and so I thought maybe it's not going to be quite as vile, but yeah, thanks to the internet, it really was quite vile.
Yeah, and so it was in 2019 when you decided to write an article on your website, you know, kind of out laying out your position and your concerns. What was it that you said?
Well, it's a 5,000 word blog post, you know, and I I basically just outlined all the terms and how I understand them to be just really clear, to avoid misunderstandings, you know, that how I understand things and how I perceive this ideology to understand certain terms, you know. And then I sort of put them next to one another, said, explained what things mean to me, how I understand, you know, biological facts to function, and that to me, I can't go along with this idea that I need to validate someone else's idea of themselves. That's just not how the world functions. And I also, yeah, I'm not a support human for other people. And they're free to feel about themselves how they want to feel about themselves. But if that demands me going along with that, then that's where I draw the line. And to me, that's just healthy boundary drawings. And, you know, I criticize Stonewall in this because I think they're massively culpable in what's been happening here over the past few years. Made a few sort of displays of what trans rights activists have so far done in terms of harassing women and, you know, that exhibition in San Francisco Public Library and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and just sort of like thought, you know, maybe that's going to open a few people's eyes. And it has, you know, over the time that it's been up. It's also made a lot of people incredibly angry, but, you know, such is the nature of doing anything in the public eye, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and what did people accuse you of? You know, when the people who were detractors, let's say, what were they angry about?
Well, I mean, they were angry because I didn't toe the party line, you know, because I have a social media platform through my art and I published that. And so it wasn't just like three friends of mine that read that. It was quite a few 100,000 people who read it because it got such outrage. And yeah, I think the problem is what I'm accused of, obviously, is transphobia, which is completely, you know, unfounded bullshit. And it's also really difficult to make it stick just because I have no issue with trans people and people know this because of my background. I think it was so difficult for a lot of people that are so steeped in this ideology to accept that someone could sort of like break their ranks, turn around and go, hang on, like, what the fuck are we doing? Because, you know, that's so much more difficult to, I guess, disavow than if I was like a right-wing Christian and say those things, you know? It's so they really try to shut me up, which sort of just never really worked. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's why the outrage was so bad, because I had a platform and people were listening. And this was like a year before J.K. Rowling wrote what she wrote. And, you know, so it wasn't here. I mean, there's been many women who've talked about this for a long time. And it took me a while to obviously come to the point and hear them. But I think it was particularly because, you know, I used to raise funds for, like, help raising funds for the Vagina Museum, which is so painfully woke that, honestly, it is. Yeah, it's a sad, sad case. And there's also Bloody Good Period. I used to design patches for them. They provide, you know, period products for people that can't afford it, like immigrants, usually immigrant women. And then they went painfully woke. And all of these companies have completely publicly distanced themselves from me after I wrote that and tried the whole like, but Jess, but you know, but look, it's so and so and so and so, and just lots of emotional manipulation going on. But yeah, essentially, I think the outrage was so big then because I was kind of someone who was seen as part of the whole London creative underground scene, you know. And suddenly I went, eh, and called bullshit. And that did not go down so well.
Yeah. It's sort of amazing. Like, how does a vagina museum go woke?
It's bonkers. Yeah, it's absolutely bonkers. But, like, proper. I mean, the woman who runs it, who was all over me when I first met her on the street in Edinburgh because of my necklace, my big swinging ovary necklace. That's how we met. And then we ended up meeting up in London. And she said she's got this project, Vagina Museum. And I thought, great. And and then I ran embroidery workshops, like Vagestic Mandala embroidery. and to raise money, to help raise money to open the doors of that museum. And then they all went, oh yeah, but you know, trans women are the most oppressed and have the most vaginas or whatever. I have no idea. I mean, it's completely fucking weird. I don't know, but yeah, I am now the antichrist for all those organizations. But because I was so involved in all of this stuff without realizing how, or the feminist library, the feminist library, they have gone completely off the woke end as well. All those places I used to do collaborations with and work with, and being slightly oblivious as to what has seeped into their ranks, you know, so yeah.
So now what is it? Let's talk about what happened with the London Royal Academy. They were carrying some of your patches in their shop. Is that right?
Yeah, my embroidery patches. So in order to be able to concentrate more on my own projects or on my commission projects for patrons that, you know, give me contracts, and not have to sort of subsidize my work with hairdressing, which is what I've done for the longest time. I sort of over the years build up little, you know, side hustles. One of them being those Patch Yourself Happy patches, which is just floral embroidery patches that you can iron on to your bag, your clothes, whatever, you know, just nice decorative flowers. There's nothing sexual about it. There's nothing, you know, it's nothing to do with all the other stuff that I do, because I also have patches that are, you know, ovaries that give the middle finger and that kind of stuff. None of that. They're just purely pretty flowers. And over the past few years, because they're very unique, they're very different to what you normally get on the shop that comes from China, because they're sort of based on my floral embroideries. You know, I digitally design them and then I get them made, and they're just very unique and very unusual in terms of embroidery patches, because they're super intricate, which embroidery patches normally are not. So there's quite a few big places in London that contacted me and wanted to stock them, and have stocked them for quite a long time. And so the Royal Academy got in touch last year, start of last year, and asked me to give them, you know, a product catalog. And so they wanted to stock them. And I thought, this is the thing, like I got attacked so many times when collaborating with smaller companies, you know, like there was a little period product company in India, and when I collaborated with them, they got piled on with no end. It was horrible, to the fact that I had to step away from it because I just didn't want to put that onto them. And, you know, all that piling on just completely affected me being able to collaborate with anyone. But when the Royal Academy got in touch, I thought, well, that's the biggest art institution in the UK. Surely they won't be swayed by this kind of stuff. And also, you know, I mean, all week long now, there were so many newspaper articles saying, how can they stock stuff by Picasso and Gauguin and, you know, artists who raped their daughters and whatnot, and then not stock the floral patches because Jester Walls thought the wrong thoughts. Because it's not even directed, you know, but that's the crux of it. But I mean, it was so screwed up because they have been there for more than a year and nobody knew, because I learned to just be quiet about these things and just have my nice little side hustle, you know. Because to me, sure, it's the biggest art institution in the UK, but at the end of the day, I have my work. I love doing what I do for my own sake. I don't want to be represented by a gallery or anything like that. I quite like how it's all panned out for myself. And so it's not, yeah, it's nice that they're there, but it's just one of a bunch of places that I supply with those patches. And I was a bit hungover last Monday and didn't think, when I posted on my Patreon, which, you know, obviously there's a paywall, with the lowest tier being £1. But I posted on there because usually I just kind of tell about what my dailies, you know, like I show behind the scenes stuff, you know, the pictures I've currently worked on and this sort of thing. And then I wrote on there, oh, and I just, you know, popped the latest order to the Royal Academy in the post, and forgot about it. And Tuesday was when all this crazy went off, because turns out somebody must literally pay money on my Patreon. I mean, that's so Stasi. Somebody must pay money on my Patreon to snoop on me, basically. Because then, unbeknownst to me, while just sitting in a garden and stitching, there was this yet again social media campaign mounting against me. And you know, it's amazing. Like, you know, there's been Knittergate and Crochetgate and whatnot, you know, where they all went crazy online against one another. And now here is yet another embroidery gate. And so I only found out about it during kind of lunch when I went on Instagram and I saw a good friend of mine who used to have a little art shop that also stocked my patches. And so, and I see her in her story on Instagram tagging me. And having a massive rant like, fuck off, this is my friend, leave her alone, you know, all these stupid accusations, get the fuck out of my email. And and I thought, what's going on? And so I just quickly texted her and she's like, oh, you know, they're just accusing me of some bullshit, fuck them, I need to go back to work, you know, don't worry about it. So I didn't, and I didn't know still what had occurred. And then, you know, slowly but surely more and more sort of emails trickled in and direct messages with screenshots. Because the reason I missed all of the commotion was because most of those idiots have been blocked a long time ago. So I just didn't see it, didn't hear it. Just completely oblivious to this. Wall of hate waltzing my way. And then I started to get inboxes already again with all the swear words under the sun and shitty emails and, you know, all the fun. And so basically there was one woman in particular. I mean, there's several in the States and in Canada as well, but there was one woman in particular in the UK who literally ended up going on a 24-hour rant on her Instagram stories about what a piece of transphobic trash I am, and the Royal Academy has not stocked women for such a long time, and now that they slowly accept women, now they let this piece of trash just waltz in and da da da. Next post, I find my a screenshot from my website, which stupidly I had completely forgotten because I hadn't updated it for 3 years. I still had my stockist list on there, which is also how they found out about my friend Laura, because she was on there as a stockist. And so they ended up tagging all the suppliers that were on the stockist list. Like, how can you stock this transphobe? It's disgusting. And of course, the biggest fish on that list was the Royal Academy. And yeah, and then literally within the day, I got an email from the Royal Academy saying, oh, you know, this is really weird and awkward, but we've got 8 complaints from the public and about transphobia and blah, blah, blah. And we stand with the LGBTQ community, but we need to investigate this because, you know, we can't be associated with a, you know, supplier that has transphobic views. I was like, what the fuck? And so emailed back twice, actually, because it stressed me quite a bit. Not because it was such a big contract. It really wasn't. I've got much bigger contracts elsewhere. But because it's just, I mean, you know, you must know. I mean, you always seem incredibly calm about it. But it's still like a knot in the stomach that's starting to form when the next thing's happening, you know, even though it's happened so many times now. But it's just, it's a bit of a visceral feeling, I find, when there's just this wave mounting again, you know. And when it washes over into real life, it becomes really just a horrible, horrible feeling when you have to deal with your real life contacts, you know, and explain this bullshit. And so I did write back, you know, that I don't think 8 people are representative of the wider public, and that I could bring easily in excess of 8 people to explain to them why my position is not transphobic. And that I have many friends in the LGBTQ community, and you know, like I think it would be best to not escalate that into the public domain and try and find solutions. And then I went to the police the day after because it still kept going. It was relentless, and people kept sending me screenshots of all that had transpired. And so I thought, okay, fuck it. I don't know what to do. This is draining my energy. I've got work to do. I don't want to deal with this shit. And I need to somehow find a way to stop it. And I don't know how, you know, because it's so elusive. It's the internet, you know. but it affects my real life. And so I went to the police and they were very friendly, but essentially the woman there said that, you know, she said with the fact that I've got screenshots from this same person doing this bullshit last year and the year before already, because I keep them all, we could sort of, you know, make a report and then invite her voluntarily, and they could, you know, maybe caution her, but that's about it. Like, it wouldn't really go very much further. And she's like, it's not that I'm saying don't do it, it's just here is the realistic situation of what's going to happen. So I ended up not doing that, and thought, okay, maybe I look into a lawyer, because she's in the UK. And I thought, maybe if I send a cease and desist or something, like something, you know, just something to shut her up, because it's ridiculous that there's no recourse really for this cyberbullying, you know. Yeah, and then I went home, only to find out that the Royal Academy had publicly dropped me via their social media Instagram story to their 500,000 followers, and thanking those that informed them, you know, of this artist who holds transphobic views, which goes against their whatever internal, you know. And they didn't name me, but they didn't have to name me, because, you know, I mean, the shit wave was already everywhere, and everybody knew everybody that was watching. And it's like, great. And up until that point, because lots of people around me obviously watched this in horror, I had people that used to follow that woman, like other embroiderers, that then sort of came to me into my inbox going, I'm so sorry, I've been seeing what she's been doing. It's really difficult to watch and must be horrible for you. And I'm like, well, I don't see it. So, but thanks for checking in. They were like, well, you know, I don't agree with everything you say, but this is just really horrible. It's just bullying. I'm like, well, it's been bullying the whole freaking 2 years, you know, but yeah, it's definitely bullying. And just because I don't roll over and cry, it doesn't make it any less bullying, because that seems to be what they tell themselves, you know, that if someone still stands up and talks back and goes, go get fucked, then that's not bullying. I'm like, you're still the bully. Like, yeah, so I got dumped via social media, and I thought, okay, well, they put it in the public domain, I'm going to put it in the public domain. So I posted on my Twitter the screenshot of that woman reposting a screenshot of the Royal Academy, and then with a caption saying, have you seen the joyous news? Blah, 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 blah. She needed dropped, the transphobic trash, la, 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 the same old bullshit, celebrating. So I took that screenshot, posted it on Twitter, and just said, and that's where we're at. And I hadn't heard anything from the Royal Academy, nothing, until the day later, because they and I both woke up, I'm guessing, to a ton of press inbox requests. And I was like, what the hell? And thanks to, you know, the Women's Place UK meeting, meetings and generally sort of like the feminist network in the UK, I've already been acquainted with quite a lot of journalists. One of them was Janice Turner, and so she reached out, and I was like, yeah, let's talk. I really want to talk about this, because it's ridiculous. And there were so many all of a sudden, it was crazy. And so she doesn't live far from me. So in the afternoon, I actually went by for tea and coffee and cake, and we just had some, you know, had a good chat. And then the Royal Academy tried to call me frantically. I had like 3 emails, which I kind of started to miss, because I also had so many other emails in support all of a sudden, and people buying my stuff. People have been buying my stuff like crazy since last week. It's been absolutely mental, which is great. I mean, it's, backfired royally, literally. And so we were talking, and then they tried to call me again, so I called them back, and it was just the most ridiculous, nonsensical conversation. She was just not saying a lot, and she's like, how are you? And I'm like, what do you think? What? You dumped me in the middle of a shitstorm, and now you're asking me how I am. Like, really? Not so fantastic, I have to say, and I really wasn't. I was so knackered and drained by all this shit, and then all of a sudden this wave of support, which was great, but at the same time it's just really intense.
Mm-hmm. And did they explain to you, you know, why they dropped you? Without even talking to you or like...
No. They basically just said, oh, well, we kind of acted a bit hastily and we're going to have to take a step back and assess the situation. And it just looks like it's going mainstream, which was hilarious because, Janice Turner is quite a well-known journalist here. And she had emailed them for a response. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they really got the pressure from the press everywhere all of a sudden. And then I was like, yeah, so what do you want me to say? I mean, there's nothing I can do about it. You did that. I probably best hop off the call. I'm like, yeah, sure. I mean, you said nothing, basically.
Yeah, like, sure. What do they want? You to comfort them?
No idea. It was the most bizarre call ever and still stuttering. And I was like, look, just call me back when you know what you want to tell me. Because up till that point, I also didn't know whether they're going to pay me, whether they're going to send my stock back. What's the situation with that even? Never mind an apology, but nothing. And I was like, okay, well, just keep me in the loop. I'm a bit unclear as to what you actually want from me. This, you did that. It's exploding all around me like fucking firecrackers, and now you're calling me for what? And she was like, no, totally, I will be back in touch. And so then I only got a text later in the evening saying they haven't come to a conclusion yet, they will be in touch with me in the morning, but they weren't. So I texted them, and no, first I called them and they didn't answer. Oh, I called them and then Janice got in touch again saying that she's been trying to call the press office and there's no answer, which was quite bizarre. And then I texted saying, it would be really great to know what the deal is. Like, what is your plan going forward? Because you can't just batten down the hatches and just pretend you're an ostrich. She called me back and she said, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, it's, we're just gonna, we've decided to sit back, like step back and listen, because I mean, the emotions are very high and it's obviously a very, on each side, very emotional subject and people want to really just express themselves. So we're going to, make space and listen for them to express themselves. And like, people are pissed. They're really pissed and rightly so. Like, what do you mean express themselves? And that was it. I mean, nothing. I was like, and that's it. You're just going to, that's your plan of action. Okay, cool. And then unbeknownst to most of the journalists in the UK, they basically closed the press office. The press office was closed until I heard from them last night that the chief executive is gonna, or the chief of the Royal Academy, if he could call me in the morning. And that was the first time anybody heard of them, apart from some rogue employee who sort of sent an answer back to the numerous cancellation of memberships which followed this, because I mean, it was a massive public outcry here. It still is. That because there's a scheme that is called Friends of the Royal Academy, where you pay, I don't know, like £90 a year or something to see the exhibitions and get the first tickets and stuff, and they got mass cancellations, like, so it became a bit of a financial situation to deal with. But they just did not respond like to any press request. Meanwhile, I've become really good at it. And so I think I sort of became their worst nightmare. But I was just like, no, I'm not gonna fucking take that. Like, it's one thing to have to deal with a mob of blue-haired bullshit assholes who think they're queer even though they live in like straight relationships, but they have a blue fringe. I'm just so sick of them. And this is like an art institution, and it's like, gee, I mean, you're policing my thoughts quite literally, because we're talking about flower patches here. It's completely bonkers and unprecedented.
Well, yeah, so it's so much more egregious when it's coming from institutions that are meant to be defending free expression. I mean, this was sort of, how I felt when, I've done some events at public libraries here in Canada and in the U.S. And,
I witnessed that
you know,
online.
Pardon?
I witnessed that online. And it's absolutely horrific.
Yeah, like, it was insane. Oh. And, you know, it's just, you know, some of the libraries stuck by the principles. Some of them tried to weasel their way out. But, you know, these are institutions that, again, the whole point. I mean, how do you have art? How do you have libraries if you're supporting censorship?
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, and it's like, it's one thing when it's these lunatic activists. I mean, it's still incredibly offensive and it's stressful and it's scary. And you're right. I mean, it's these people who identify as queer because this is some kind of trendy thing to do, and so much of it is entirely superficial. You know, they're not oppressed minorities because they, you know, dye their hair or pierce their face or whatever. Like, they're really privileged people, actually. Like, most of these people are university educated, middle class, living in the West, etc.
Yeah, 100%.
And so so all this went down, and then today, the Royal Academy issued an apology.
Yes, they did.
So how did that happen?
Well, I mean, I think they didn't quite anticipate the loose cannon that I would become, because the thing is, I just don't give a fuck. I don't, like, genuinely. It's not like a, yeah, whatever. I just don't care. I have really great people in my life that I care about. And that's like about a handful of people, you know. They've been in my life all for a really long time. And what some strange, you know, idiot from the internet thinks of me is nothing. It doesn't matter to me. And so when they gave me the opportunity to talk, I took it. I've been literally sitting for the last 3 days talking my mouth fuzzy for, I don't know, all day long, basically, to all the major newspapers who were all too keen to listen to me. Because I thought, you know what, the thing that this thing needs is daylight, broad daylight, because this isn't going to fly if people see that I call bullshit to it, if I have the platform. But the problem is that most of the times you don't get the platform because you get deplatformed, or, you know, you already fall at the first hurdle because you've got some gender studies person who is the new intern who doesn't even let the email go to the people who might even be supportive of your views, you know. And so I thought, okay, right, I've got the podium. I'm going to shout. So I shouted, and it really obviously reached a lot of people in positions where something can be done about this. And I think it also really went to the core of the issue. I got so many emails from men also that went like, you know what, I probably don't agree with like 90% of your feminist stuff, but with this one, I'm totally with you. Because it is about freedom of expression and freedom of speech. And I think people are starting to realize this more and more and more. And then there's me sitting there going, yeah, fuck you, I don't care. You know, you can call me whatever you want, but this is bullshit. And I think particularly in Britain, that's just not so the done thing. It's a bit more of a German kind of, you know, straightforward, no bullshit kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think there was a period, I mean, maybe things are changing a bit now, but when people thought, they were so used to being successful in canceling people, so they were so used to, you know, going after somebody on Twitter and, you know, demanding retraction or apology and getting it. And I think that when they end up trying to deal with people like us who don't give a fuck and are like, no, I'm not apologizing. I didn't do anything wrong. Like, I don't care what you say about me or what you think about me. They sort of, they don't really know exactly how to deal with that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, in fact, it makes them even more outraged, because how dare you? There were people accusing me almost more of being rude than transphobic. And I'm like, yeah, I'm fucking rude. Get pissed. I mean, honestly, who the fuck are you? And then they were like, oh, you talk about cancel culture, you delete all the comments on your on your Instagram. And I'm like, yeah, it's not your fucking marketplace.
And that's not canceling you. Like, it's my Instagram account. I'm not obligated to host your every single stupid little comment and opinion. Give me a break.
But also, I mean, it gives me great pleasure to block them because I know it annoys them so much. So, you know, it's become a bit of a, you know, what's that, you know, where you tap the kitten on the head when it keeps poking the head out. It's a bit like that. But no, I mean, this insistence that just because they have the access to the internet and they dislike something, that person should have to listen to their crap. It's like, what? No.
Yeah. And that they should all be, that they all should be taken very seriously, that you're obligated to respond to every comment. I mean, I've been, you know, I'm constantly being attacked and trolled by all sorts of people from all sorts of groups, like across the political spectrum. But, you know, they act like it's your full-time job to read their comment, to consider it really seriously, and then take time to respond. And it's like, you know, I don't even know who you are. You're an, like, half of these at least are anonymous accounts. Your comment is stupid. I've already expressed my position over and over and over again very clearly. Yeah. And you're so entitled to me and my time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so okay, so they've apologized, and then what happens next? Are they bringing your art back into the shop?
Yeah. So the guy apologized, which, I mean, it's a big deal. I know that there were people on Twitter going, "Oh, but you know, they didn't do it there, and it should have been more this, and they should have tagged you." And I'm like, "Come on, everybody is seeing it, literally." This is like a major thing, like that the chief of the Royal Academy calls me to apologize. It's a big deal, and it's a grown up thing to do, you know, and I believe it was sincere. I genuinely think it was sincere, and we spoke a couple of more times also when that silly employee did the performative tweet or whatever the fuck. I spoke with him about that too. No, I think it's sincere. But the reality is, it is a massive organization, and organizations here have been to a certain extent captured, as we've now just witnessed. And that's not just going to leave. There's still lots of entitled idiots who think they can just get away with doing stuff like that, and they can't. And I think this will be dealt with, you know. And it needs to be called out. It's just bullshit. And I'm not going to stand for it. I mean, lots of people kind of always think when you have a, you know, verified tick on your social media, like a lot of these kids or what, young people, they think it means that, because I've heard that accusation so many times, oh, you're punching down, you know, you're a rich white cis woman, whatever. And I'm like, yeah, rich. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, now I am. Thanks. But before that, I was like living hand in mouth. I mean, I live in London and I make art and subsidize it with hairdressing. Rich is quite far away from that scenario. So it's ridiculous, but because they all live online in this imagined world, these things carry weight, you know? So you have a blue tick, and I'm like, I have a blue tick because I've done a lot of stuff within art in the real life, you know, like I've ran exhibitions at the Tate. I've done some major collaborations with sort of feminist organizations and, you know, for the suffragette centenary and stuff like stuff, newsworthy stuff. That's why I'm verified. Not because I've got so many Twitter followers or like Instagram followers or whatever, or not because I'm rich, because I'm not. But yeah, I mean, it's complete. It's all just bullshit, illusion, and sort of like online credibility. It's just so ridiculous and fake. And
yeah, I mean, yeah. And it really speaks to, you know, the way that these people are more than anything else, which is that they operate in this kind of online fantasy world where it's assumed that because, you know, you have a platform, because you have a lot of followers, because you have a blue tick, that this means that you're rich and powerful. And they don't even think that through at all and think, oh, this is just an independent artist. She's probably not a wealthy person. Or even maybe I just shouldn't make baseless assumptions about what's going on her end. And then it's also just like, it's actually none of your business. And the fact that you think that I'm obligated to be poor and that this is something that you get to, like, it's like, you know, I'm sure you work really hard. You deserve to have an income and be comfortable in your life. Like, what a fucking stupid thing to attack somebody over.
But according to that, you know, group of people, I think even... I don't even know what I would have to do, because obviously apologizing is out of the question, but like disappearing from the face of the earth, and even that would probably not even do. But there were literally people tagging me and going, transphobes should not be part of the embroidery community. I'm like, I'm not part of your fucking community. I don't care about your perceived community. Like, but anyway, yeah, so they are reinstating my patches, and it wasn't like, oh, we're going to do this. It was the other way around. That's why it was very, courtesy. No, how do you say that? It was courteous? A very courteous, yeah, phone call. And cause I said, what's going to happen with the patches? And he said, you know, I kind of feel like I would have to ask you for permission. I mean, obviously we would reinstate them, but I don't know if you still want that, you know, after all we've done to you. And I'm like, no, I think they should go back. Definitely.
Yeah. You know? Well, this is like such a great outcome. I'm so glad about how this went down. Like, I know it's been really stressful for you and awful. I know how it feels. It's totally mentally and physically and emotionally draining, and it sucks to be treated like that, and it often has an impact on your personal life. You know, I'm sure that you've lost friends over this kind of stuff, and that part's really hard.
I've been really lucky, because that's what I mean. I've got a really strong core group of friends who, you know, I've been given them my blog post to proofread. My husband is super supportive of everything I do. You know, and no, I don't. I mean, I lost people that were in my life and now they're not, but whatever. Like, so I'm lucky in that respect, because I know people have been completely ditched. I lost my place of work, you know, in the theater because of the social media mob. But still, I mean, I don't know. I'm like the eternal optimist kind of thing. I just keep going and do my stuff, and things are working out really great, but it has been extremely tiring. And the other thing is, I'm really glad I have a garden, because right now, you know, I'm not particularly subtle in terms of what I look like. So I'm just incredibly self-conscious. I don't feel like I could just go for a park walk right now. It's just a bit too extreme, and it makes me feel a bit socially anxious, which is a bit shit, but we kind of want to leave London anyway, so, you know.
yeah, I feel you. It was really great to talk with you finally. We've sort of been connected for a while now, and I mean, I'm glad that this happened, because I'm not trying to be like, I'm glad this happened to you, but it's a good thing. Like, it shows that things are changing, and it's pushing things to change. And, you know, I'm glad that they tried to go after someone like you, who is really not going to bow down or compromise at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is the thing. I had those conversations with my husband last week, and he was saying, you know, I know we always said it needed something like that, but I didn't quite think it'd be you. Me neither. You know, but I totally agree. I mean, if anything, I can at least sort of carry that burden, you know, and then I'm just going to have to go on a really nice holiday and send lots of social media pictures that are going to piss off the haters.
Totally. You have to. I mean, the thing that makes the most angry is when we continue to be like happy people and to live our lives.
But I mean, I have no plans to do anything other than exactly that.
Great. So, you know. I'll let you go. I know you're exhausted and you probably really need a break and a rest, so thanks again. I really appreciate you taking the time, and we'll be in touch in the future for sure.
Yes, please. You too.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye. You just heard an interview with artist Jess DeWalls. To learn more about her work, visit jessdewalls.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.